Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. Today, we will be doing a deep dive into one of Martin Scorsese's most underrated films, 1982's The King of Comedy, all the while analyzing how this gem's commentary on the American obsession with fame speak to how the general public indulges in parasocial relationships to celebrities in the age of the internet. So, with that being said, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. I'm Norma Levy, and I'm the president and founder of New Plaza Cinema. Today, we're looking forward to a lively discussion about the very special Martin Scorsese 1982 film called The King of Comedy with Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis. And now I'm pleased to introduce our wonderful curator, Gary Palmucci.
Hi, Norma. Thank you very much. Well, it was one of our greatest living filmmakers' most ambitious films on the horizon early next year. This seems like an ideal time to take another look at Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy. Back in the summer of 1981, King of Comedy was filming at various locations in Midtown Manhattan and on the Upper East and West Side. It seemed like on many late afternoons that summer, as I walked home from work from 9th Avenue across town to the East Side, I would frequently encounter the production company shooting somewhere as if for my own and thousands of other New Yorkers' personal delectation. For example, at those long gone payphones near Times Square where Robert De Niro monopolizes a phone, waiting for an unlikely call back while others fume, including members of the great band The Clash, who were in the kind of peak of their fame at that moment. The big argument between Robert De Niro and Sandra Bernhardt on 49th Street and Broadway.
Schmucko Supremo last
Hold
night.
Hold on a minute. I'm the schmuck, me. Oh, you're wrong, really, buddy. Chris. You're very wrong.
Yeah. Across from the cavernous, long-gone Rivoli movie theater. 53rd Street and Park Avenue, where the Jerry Lewis character gets kidnapped.
Get over. Get in there. I'm not fooling.
What are you talking?
What are you doing?
You're crazy.
Sort of. And East 58th Street between 1st and New York Avenues, the site of Jerry Lewis's character's penthouse apartment with all those TV screens, including one of them tuned to Scorsese favorite Sam Fuller's pickup on South Street. It was a laborious 19-week shoot, very expensive, that didn't connect with audiences at all, really, in its original theatrical release. But over time, the prescient dark humor of King of Comedy has come to be much better appreciated, to the point where for many of us, I think it's now considered one of Scorsese's best and most daring pictures, although at that time he would certainly not have said so, and we'll get into that, a little bit of that later.
My memory of the film was originally seeing it in, I think it was the Plaza Theater in Westwood in 1983, and absolutely coming out of the theater hating every second of it and just couldn't believe what Scorsese had done. And maybe 6 months later, I was watching cable TV and King of Comedy was on, and I found myself laughing and laughing and laughing and cringing in a good way and getting what the film was finally about. And then 2 years later, when After Hours was released, I remember there was a review in the, I think it was the LA Weekly, where the critic referenced John Huston having the same reaction to King of Comedy as I had. He hated it when he first saw it, and then he watched it on cable TV and loved it and totally changed his views
yes,
on it.
Yes, we can just hear a big belly laugh coming from John Huston right there as he's watching it somewhere in the...
Absolutely. Cut. And when I revisited it the other night, it registered with me that I think one of the reasons I was so uncomfortable watching it, on top of all the other reasons any American would be uncomfortable watching this cringeworthy indictment of the unhealthy American obsession and celebrity glorification. And when I saw the film originally, I was a secretary at an entertainment company, and we were used to dealing with people in the lobby trying to get in to see executives. They had a script. Can so-and-so read it? He knows who I am. Please let me in. And maybe it just struck too close to home at the time. I couldn't.
And you probably had one of those bouncers like the fellow in the Jerry Langford office who comes out and tries to talk reasonably at first to Robert De Niro, and things start off reasonably, and then he winds up getting physically thrown out of the building.
You did have the security aspect of it, but this film today definitely has even more relevance when we think that this was made before the internet, before reality TV, before YouTube made everybody a star, regardless of whether they had talent or not. And you see this movie, and it's incredibly sobering. My reaction, and I've seen it since then, in addition to my recent viewing, and I remember the first hour, I'm laughing quite a bit, and then you stop laughing because it's really getting uncomfortable, especially when Rupert and the Rita character show up at Jerry's house, and it's getting a little on the icky side. And it's also important to remember that this project came out of some pretty horrible real-life situations that were connecting to Scorsese, De Niro films. There was the whole John Hinckley watching Taxi Driver and communicating with Jodie Foster and then trying to kill Reagan when he was president. And then there was the awful case with the Raging Bull actress Teresa Saldana was nearly stabbed to death by a crazy stalker.
That's right.
She lived to tell about it. And that when Scorsese and De Niro were offered this project, they felt, hey, I think the time is ripe to really satirize and go after the fan culture.
The screenplay was by, I think the only screenplay, a former Newsweek film critic, Paul Zimmerman. And you know, as you said, 3 months before they started shooting had been the assassination attempt on President Reagan. And the attack on Teresa Saldana, I believe, was that same year as well.
Exactly. So there was some very intense real life situations that led them to do this take on the culture, the fan culture, which we remember is short for fanatic, and Pupkin's character in particular, right down to the basement monologues and very uncomfortable rehearsals and fantasies.
And that of course, if many people will recognize that's Mrs. Scorsese. Who's constantly yelling down from the kitchen for him to keep the volume down, you know, when he's doing his recordings. You know, I don't mind what you're saying, but just not so loud.
As in Mama Scorsese, Catherine.
Yes, that's
Catherine.
Right.
And also what I noticed the other night in the very first scene when Rupert is outside the television studio waiting for Jerry to come out with the crazy fans, right behind him, briefly, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Ah, she would later be a Scorsese player in The Color of Money.
Exactly.
That is one of my favorite freeze frames, I think. The title card, when it comes on and we see the window closing and Sandra Bernhardt, you know, screaming and everybody kind of ducking or whatever in one direction or another and then, you know, freezing on the title. That's a beautiful beginning.
And that was a title designed by Dan Perry, who had previously did the titles for Taxi Driver in New York, New York, and was bringing a new artistic sensibility to title design in the post-Saul Bass era.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the film today, I think, is easier to follow than it originally. We take for granted, for example, some of the editing tricks they were playing, the Sardi's restaurant fantasy, where you see De Niro and Lewis at Sardi's.
Hey, it's not that big a deal to think. I'm asking you
thinking.
To just think.
I'm thinking. You're always telling me to think. That's all I do is think day and night about it. How can I not think about it? I mean,
I'm and then they intercut that with Rupert in his basement having this delusional
Rupert
fantasy.
I want you to take over the show for 6 weeks, just 6 weeks. I can't take over my life for 6 weeks.
And then going back and forth seamlessly. And that was pretty unusual for a mainstream feature. Other aspects of the editing are a bit on the rough side. I think for a film as massively budgeted as this, it's maybe a little puzzling where, and this is not uncommon in some of Scorsese's work, where because there's improvisation or there's from take to take, they're probably doing different emphasis on lines. There is not always a smoothness in how the scenes are put together. When we think of Jerry and Rupert in the limousine in the beginning, you can see as they're cutting from angle to angle, people are moving around less fluidly than they normally would. And there is a particularly jarring example when Rupert and Masha are walking past the Brill Building and they stop to talk, or they're yelling at each other. And then we cut to Sandra Bernhardt and the camera is tracking. And then we cut back to De Niro and it's stationary.
Hmm.
That's one of the weirdest editing gaffes I've seen, but
I mean, I guess it must have seemed like a great idea to just shoot the film right in the middle of Midtown in Times Square and so forth. But it went on and on and on for many weeks, way over budget. And I think was very arduous personally for Scorsese. In an interview several years later, he was describing the production. He said, imagine when a shoot gets so difficult. And he's talking to the guys who were documentary filming, as you know what production is like. He says, you get to the point, imagine getting to the point where you don't care about the picture anymore. And that's what he said at the time. I find that a little hard to believe coming from him. But,
it is. I mean, he claimed he'd been coming off of three other pictures. He'd done New York, New York, and The Last Waltz and Raging Bull pretty much back to back. And then this project was thrown his way. And as you said, it was a very expensive film. At the time, costing around 19 to 20 million. In today's currency, that's over 62 million. That's a lot of money. And also, you mentioned the shoot. Officially, they have the film starting production in June of 1981, but they clearly went back for some pickup shots because the Times Square shots, if you're like me and like any other movie fan, we're always looking at the movie marquees.
That's right,
to see the show.
Sure.
They're showing The World According to Garp. They're showing Blade Runner, which came out in the summer of 82.
Exactly.
So they clearly went back and did some pickup shots for some of those. And when you see these scenes in Times Square and near the Paramount Plaza building where De Niro and Sandra Bernhard are walking, there seem to be people stopping and staring. So they had extras, but you have to wonder if some of that was done candidly as well. It's fascinating.
Or a hidden camera, because Midnight Cowboy had some famous shots like that a decade earlier. But yeah.
Precisely. And one element that Scorsese plays around with is in the fantasies, using videotape for part of the fantasies, including the fantasy online, that's a 21st century term, network marriage between him and Masha.
That's right.
Was shot on videotape.
Victor Borge and Dr. Joyce Brothers, you know, fresh from the Johnny Carson show. And another beautiful bit of parody, that ridiculously inane, lead-in music to the show.
And now, direct from New York, it's the Jerry Langford Show.
Which, of course, is, you know, goofing on the many talk show intros of that time. You know, our friend Dave Kerr over at the Museum of Modern Art, 2 or 3 years ago, he put together a program, I think mostly of a tribute to Jerry Lewis, but he put The King of Comedy and The Nutty Professor together on sort of a double feature. And he feels these films had some kind of kinship, which I'm not quite sure I can explain verbally, but I feel like he's right in my head. What do you think of that?
Well, let's see. You do have Rupert's trying to take over the Jerry Langford character. In The Nutty Professor, you have the Jerry Lewis character. He's two personalities.
The ultra dweeb and the ultra slick musician. Yes. Buddy Love, is that his name?
Buddy Love, exactly, exactly. And you have, what are some other elements that stood out for me you talk about the talk show satire. Clearly, there seemed to be a modeling on the Tonight Show setup.
Right.
Where we see Jerry in the beginning, Ed Herlihy is standing in for Ed McMahon, and then there's a guy running the band who's clearly the Doc Severinsen character. And apparently Johnny Carson had been approached to play the Jerry Langford part originally and turned it down, but that the Tonight Show was credited as having provided some technical information on these things. But we also have Fred DeCordova, the producer of The Tonight Show, playing presumably the producer of the Jerry Langford Show.
That's another terrific scene where he's the guy who gets on the phone and he thinks the call is fake. He says to the young man, I think his name is Martino, and he said, how many? And then somehow or other, you know, that Jerry Langford convinces them that it's really him. And then there's a guy sitting nearby, a business manager, who said, I want you to know, we're going to sue them all. And he is, in fact, a guy named Jay Julian, a famous actor, a business manager of that time. So these guys were cast to type for sure.
Absolutely. And there's weird things. This goes back to some of the editing continuity. But here's one thing that was clearly deliberate. There's the scene where Rupert is having dinner or drinks with Rita, the Diane Abbott character. And there's that man in the background with the beard. He's kind of at a booth in the background. Then he's gone. Then he's crossing behind De Niro. Then he's back there and he's imitating De Niro's gestures.
There's a number of cameos in that bar scene. There's Marty's dad, Charlie Scorsese. He's sitting at the bar at the very end when Rupert goes on national television. And also the character we know from Goodfellas, known as Murray the Hairpiece King, a gentleman named Chuck Lowe, who I guess was a friend of Robert De Niro. He's also in the bar scene.
And I think one of the bar patrons, or at one point, is Mardik Martin, the screenwriter who co-wrote Mean Streets.
Yeah, kind of a forgotten figure in the Scorsese biography, collaborator on Mean Streets and Who's That Knocking at My Door, I think.
And New York, New York as well.
Right. So, passed away, I think, a few years ago.
Yeah, that's really, really unfortunate. And so there's a lot of in-jokes here. I'm just remembering bits and pieces of interviews. A number of years later, Sandra Bernhard mentioned The King of Comedy, and she indicated that her memories were that Jerry Lewis was not comfortable with some of the improvisation that was going on, that he felt it was unprofessional.
Yes.
And she also felt he was scared of her. I can't imagine why.
Well, just as Joe Pesci and Kathy Moriarty in Raging Bull were sort of casting miracles, I think she's kind of a casting miracle, perhaps not in the way that everyone intended, but certainly a memorable performance.
Yes, and it takes some while to get used to her on screen, but at the candlelight scene, I think she's quite outstanding where he's all taped up.
And that's what Jerry Lewis really has to, he's like completely taped up and he's just got that look of boiling rage that has to build. And that's like a 10 or 15 minute scene, I believe, or something. It's pretty long anyway.
It is, and it's a tribute to both of them that he has to really be the reactor rather than the act in that scene.
Maybe we should hear from Dan about what his investigations have yielded here.
I am shocked that neither of you gentlemen mentioned the fact that at the time, Diane Abbott was Mrs. Robert De Niro. So I'm glad I scooped that one up. She, I think, lasted until 88 as his wife.
Well, she had a couple of wonderful cameos. She plays the porno theater candy seller in Taxi Driver, and she has her wonderful performance of Honeysuckle Rose in New York, New York, which some of us remember.
Once again, I have to take my hat off to Jerry Lewis for giving, I think, one of the best performances of his career.
Scorsese felt that the performance was very underrated, that Lewis should have gotten more recognition for it, and I would agree with that.
Yeah, indeed.
It wasn't until after seeing the film, maybe another viewing, I realized, and I'm sure this was part of the intention all the time, in addition to being a merciless commentary on our celebrity culture, it could be interpreted as a comic turn on Taxi Driver. Because Taxi Driver, when we think about it, culminates with this psychotic becoming a media celebrity because he killed the right people instead of the wrong people. And you have the newspaper headlines about Travis Bickle.
Well, yeah, not to quite the same extent, I don't think, Max. I think what we saw in Taxi Driver, we see something like a New York Post type headline pinned to the wall saying, hero cab driver returns to work.
Yeah, you're right. He's not on television.
This is really over the top. You know,
over the top. The Monthly Film Bulletin in England cited what they thought was glib irony in The King of Comedy. So I guess with that final touch that Dan referring to, perhaps rubbing our noses in it just a bit. Jerry Lewis apparently said in an interview long ago that he had suggested that Rupert kill the Jerry Langford character at the end, but that was overruled and he felt the picture was lacking a proper finish. Interesting.
Maybe he just wanted a death scene. I don't know that he had that many death scenes in his career. Have either of you ever encountered The Day the Clown Cried?
Still pretty tough to see, I think.
No.
Okay. I was
at the Library of Congress when the 35 millimeter cans arrived from some source, and they were on like a loading dock, but that was the closest I got to it.
Maybe for those who are not familiar with the Day the Clown Cried, you guys could give a little synopsis. I think you know a little bit more about it than I do.
Jerry plays a clown who ends up in a death camp in World War II with a lot of children. And all I know is that he goes to his death with the children. And maybe Max knows more than I do, but...
Yeah, so the film went into production around 1972 and was based on a literary source. And I believe there were rights clearance issues that led to the film being considered an unauthorized version of the literary source, which prevented it from being released. And at the time, people thought, well, this is an outrageous idea. What's Jerry Lewis doing, dealing with the Holocaust and a clown? But then in 1997, 98, we have Roberto Benigni making Life is Beautiful.
Well, a generation later.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, they could get away with it then, but...
Lewis was quoted as saying he didn't release the movie ultimately because he didn't think it was that good of a picture. Some people who saw sections of it felt that it was better than its reputation. I don't think it was helped by the fact that back in the late 80s, I believe it was, Spy Magazine did a big article about The Day the Clown Cried, interviewing people who had seen it, who were kind of scratching their heads and trying to cobble together a film that Spy Magazine assumed to be totally ridiculous.
In his will, if I remember correctly now, there's some access to the film can be granted sometime in the next decade or so. I think it's not completely going to be kept in mothballs. I think he did allow some access to it in his will or something. So we may hear more about that film. Of course, at the time King of Comedy was made, Jerry had made a couple of independent films, unsuccessful, but he was far, far removed from his perch as one of the biggest movie stars, the biggest entertainers in America. Scorsese, in one article I remember, described his dad taking him to see Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin at the Paramount Theater live in 1948 when he was 6 years old.
I would recommend to anyone who has even a small interest in Martin and Lewis, Turner Classic Movies did a wonderful documentary within the last year on Dean Martin. And there is a lot of footage of those two guys touring to promote their early films. Mm-hmm. And indeed, my dad took me to one of these big theaters, and it was like the Beatles, but with screaming little kids, not teenage girls.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was total pandemonium. We couldn't really hear anything they were saying, but they were really well known for improv comedy. In particular, when they appeared on live TV, like late night shows, they would go nuts. But by the time they got to Hollywood, they were kind of scripted into situations that didn't really suit their wild weirdness. So they were the biggest thing in Hollywood in their heyday, and not so anymore.
And I believe Peter Bogdanovich published an extensive interview with Jerry Lewis in his book about movie stars. He, if memory serves, he said that Lewis starred in 16 consecutive hits in a row, which broke the record of many stars. And Lewis is kind of, he's the celebrity that most Americans refuse to acknowledge ever liking. I mean, the guy was a massive star, but nobody wants to admit ever going to his films. And it took the French to really recognize his work in the 1960s and appreciate some of the surrealistic narratives and his even avant-garde approaches to comedy at times. But stuff was massive, and he was starring in and directing his own pictures till around 1970. And then he made The Day the Clown Cried, which wasn't shown. But it is going to be almost another decade. As Gary said, he's going to make some independent films like Hardly Working, which got picked up by Fox and did okay. But the big days of directing major films were behind him.
And I think part of his success was that he appealed to the boomer generation. That's me, when we were little kids.
Yes.
And when a little kid says, I got to go see Martin and Lewis, your mom and dad took you, you know, and yes. They were kind of maybe interested a little bit themselves. But I think it was mainly a kid driven audience.
I remember seeing It's Only Money. I think he didn't direct that. That was directed by Frank Tashin. But when I was 7 years old, when he's getting chased by a series of power lawnmowers or something that have gone haywire. That's
Okay, so since we're confessing here, this sounds like an exaggeration, but I swear to you, my very first memory of a film image in the cinema is a woman in a car trying to parallel park and bumping the car in front of her and behind her. And for decades, I couldn't figure out what this movie was until one day I was doing some data entry work and I happened to have Jerry Lewis's The Patsy on DVD and I was watching it. It was from The Patsy. So my first exposure or memory of a film is a Jerry Lewis picture.
Yeah.
And Max, we were discussing the other day, and I think you have an interesting anecdote about the failure of the film at the time kind of resulted in kind of the low point of Scorsese's career, and that he was trying to get The Last Temptation of Christ made right after this film and its box office failure, plus some early protests and pressure on the studio prompted President Michael Eisner to pull the plug on Last Temptation. And Marty tried to get the film off the ground unsuccessfully elsewhere, including one of your former employers, right?
Right. So Scorsese has made Taxi Driver, which did very well commercially. He follows it up with New York, New York, which was an expensive failure. I said recently it had the misfortune of opening up the same week as Star Wars in 1977. Then he makes The Last Waltz, a dignified so-so performer. And then Raging Bull, which, believe it or not, we regard highly today, but was also a failure when it came out. So, yes, and then this Last Temptation of Christ disappointment happens at Paramount. So not long after the release of King of Comedy, I was working at ABC Motion Pictures, which was a theatrical arm of ABC. It was their second attempt to enter feature film production. I was the secretary to the assistant of the president, Brandon Stoddard. And sure enough, the Martin Scorsese came into the office one day to pitch The Last Temptation of Christ. And his secretary and I were on very bad terms. We did not like each other. So I waited for her to leave the office and hang out with another secretary. And I did a very Rupert Pupkin-like thing. I snuck into the outer office, put my ear to the door so I could listen to the pitch meeting. And I heard little bits and pieces where Stoddard was asking Scorsese, so tell me, what stage is this project in right now? Tell me more about it. And Scorsese, who was going through his rapid speech pattern days, was saying, well, this is a film about Jesus Christ as a man, you know, not so much as a big religious figure, but as a man. So that was the pitch. I heard the secretary coming, so I ran back to my desk. But that was one of the first three times I saw Martin Scorsese in person.
Well, that's it. So it was kind of a nadir for him. And then he took on, I think, smartly, as it turned out, a couple of films where you could almost say are like commissioned projects in some ways. After Hours for producer David Geffen and The Color of Money at the Disney studio, with a sort of sequel to The Hustler. But both of those movies turned out well and got him to the next level, where he was then able to make The Last Temptation of Christ with help from various powers that be.
Well, he was even reduced to directing an episode of Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories, which
a lot of name directors jumped onto that. Clint Eastwood did an episode of that series.
Burt Reynolds. And yeah, it was a strange experience. So, yes, After Hours, it was much more modestly budgeted than some of Scorsese's recent films, and that enabled him to get in the door to do some other films. Dan, do you have anything to add about the look of The King of Comedy? Because I remember going to see it, a lot of us were disappointed by the look, and I think we missed the point, because could it be argued that Scorsese was trying to get more of a TV look in a lot of situations, because we're used to the Michael Chapman glossy look of Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, this movie is mostly taking place in the real world of studios and offices and waiting rooms. So indeed, there isn't a lot of inventive photography. And the DP on this, Fred Schuller, is not a particularly well-known person,
Gordon Willis, assistant cameraman, like originally, that's his background. Okay. He worked on The Godfather, I think, among others.
Okay.
Probably, yeah.
Most interesting. Well, this has been so fascinating, gentlemen. Take care, everyone.
This discussion was facilitated by film curator Gary Palmucci, film historian Max Alvarez, and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was directed, produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Also, we want to hear from you. What film would you like us to cover on the next episode of the New Plaza Cinema podcast? Be sure to cast your vote in the poll link in the episode description. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Take care.